Well, in this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about intellectual property and the internet. With the coming of the internet, with the coming of more and more ways to obtain and exchange different kinds of information, and including things like music and movies and books and magazine articles and newspaper articles and all kinds of things, that now that people can obtain them, store them, pass them around electronically, it has posed a number of new and sometimes thorny questions having to do with intellectual property and copyright issues. So we'll try and talk about some of these things this morning with our guest. He's Jay Kaysen, and he is professor of law at the University of Illinois. In addition to having an appointment in the College of Law, he also has positions in the Department of Electrical and Computer Engineering and the Institute of Government and Public Affairs. So you can see how these issues cross a number of disciplines. He is a graduate of Georgetown Law School, but he also has a PhD in electrical and computer engineering from University of Texas at Austin. And in fact, before he decided to go to law school, he worked for IBM as a research scientist. He has been with us before on the program to talk about some of these issues and was good enough to come back. And we'll take up a number of things. And we want to make sure that people who are listening know that, as always is the case, if you have a specific or particular kind of question, you're invited to call in. And I know that he will do his best to give you an answer. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So again, 333-WILL and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Yeah, thank you, and thank you for inviting me.
For people who don't deal with these issues all the time, on a regular sort of basis, maybe we should just talk a little bit about what it is we're talking about, first off, for people who may feel that this sounds sort of esoteric and perhaps not even sure. When you use a phrase like intellectual property, what is it that you're talking about?
Yeah, well, basically, when we are talking about property, people often think of real property. They think of a house, or they think of a chair or an apple that you're eating. And they don't think of a property as being something that could be intangible, something that you can't touch necessarily. And intangible property is sometimes referred to as intellectual property simply because it involves the creative process. It involves some process of creating something, an idea, and so on and so forth. And we have come to believe that we ought to have property rights in these things. And this is not a new idea, things related to intellectual property. They didn't call it that. It has been around for several centuries. Goes back to Roman times and Venetian times when people understood that if you created something new, you ought to have a right to it. Indeed, in our Constitution, it's one of the few things where an explicit right has been provided for in the Constitution. And indeed, the reason for that right is also made very clear. For example, in Article 1, Section 8, Clause 8, it says, to promote the progress of science and the useful arts, we give authors and inventors some exclusive rights to their writings and their creations for a limited period of time. Mm-hmm. In other words, the exact idea that you ought to encourage the creation of these works by giving some sort of exclusive right to that work or that creation for a period of time so that they can enjoy some rights to exclude others was well understood from day one by our forefathers and founding fathers.
Well, there are a couple of basic ways that we can protect these things. If you invent something, or even if you you actually don't even have to make it. If you come up with an idea for an invention, some sort of new product, if you can describe it and if it's unique, you can get a patent so that then you own that. And if somebody comes along and takes your idea and makes it, you can take legal action. If you write a book, you can get a copyright, which is essentially the same sort of idea. So that if, for example, I write a book and it gets published, then I have the right to the proceeds. And if somebody else should come along, go out to the bookstore, buy a copy of my book, and go down to Kinko's and make copies and set up a little stand on the sidewalk and sell it, you can't do that. So we have copyright protection. But now how is it that now when we come along and we have the internet and we now have it so that, say, Well, maybe I read something that I thought that was really interesting. Could be an entire article. It could be something pretty substantial. And I think that it'd be interesting for you to read. And so I electronically send you a copy. Why is it that somehow the existing laws don't cover the reality that now exists?
Well, I mean, before we go and dump on existing law, which I think it is okay to dump on, you know, we ought to realize the World Wide Web is only 5 or 6 years old, and we're talking about relatively new things. The law is much slower to change, and the reality is that we're talking about a medium that has enormous distribution capabilities and enormous replication capabilities, and all capable of being done perfectly thanks to digital technology, that this is something that really was not anticipated. And so the ability of the medium to transmit vast amounts of content is truly amazing. And that's one thing that does distinguish intellectual property from real property. In a sense, if there's a seat in a bus, if one person sits on that seat, it's taken, it's gone. Nobody else can. If you have an apple, you eat it, it's gone. And intellectual property is fundamentally different in that way. It's not like real property. Multiple people can use it at the same time. Multiple people can take it. And without diminishing the original work. In other words, if I ate the apple, the apple's gone. No one else can eat it. But it's not true with respect to a book. You can make multiple copies of the book, and the book still remains the same. And so I think that fundamental difference, in combination with the enormous communication capabilities of the internet, is posing all kinds of challenges to people who are creators of works. People are worried that their ability to appropriate the benefits of their hard work is being taken away from them. On the other hand, if you are someone who believes that they do have a right to profit from their work, but our ability to access the work for fair use and other purposes ought not to be taken away. After all, in the process of creating new works, we rely on old works. So dissemination is something that's very, very important as well. And this is something that lies at the heart of intellectual property, which is something that people often miss. And that is that intellectual property is not about protection. It's sort of like saying criminal law is about the rights of defendants. It simply is not. Or say that the constitutional law is about the rights of the federal government. It's not. It's about a balance between federal government and state government. It's about a balance between rights of defendants and victims. And here in this case, it's about a balance between the rights of creators and users. And it's sort of striking a balance between, if you will, progress and access. Mm-hmm. So you want to promote progress by encouraging authors and inventors. But at the same time, you need to have access to the works and things like that's why intellectual property fundamentally tries to strike that balance with concepts like fair use, with concepts like experimental use in patents and so on, and with rights for parody, commentary and so on, where you don't worry about trademark violations and so on.
Right. And it just as far as the law is concerned, the basic point that where we find ourselves now is that it is an area that has been, that is, this technology has changed so much so quickly that the law is still, and people who make law and who think about the law are still trying to figure out how exactly to deal with this, even now as we speak, changing, developing reality.
Yeah. I mean, you know, as an engineer, I was often used to thinking of unintended consequences of technology. Now I've come to realize that that's not just the exclusive province of technologists. There's unintended consequences of laws being passed by Congress and other people as well, and they don't anticipate that a law that was passed 3 or 4 years ago now is going to be applied in entirely different situations that was not contemplated by Congress at the outset.
Yeah. We're talking this morning with Jay Kaysen. He is a professor of law at the University of Illinois. He also has positions in the Department of Electrical and Computer Engineering and the Institute of Government and Public Affairs. And he teaches and writes on the areas of intellectual property and law and regulation of cyberspace, as well as science and technology and the law. And here we're talking this morning, trying to talk a little bit about some of the issues, some of the intellectual property issues raised by the internet. And if you have questions, we have a couple of people here ready to go. You're certainly welcome to call here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL or 9455. We do also have toll-free line. That's 800 1-800-222-9455. We'll start here, though, with someone locally. The caller is in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Howdy. Mm-hmm. You said something about that it's not so much protection of the copyright holders and patent holders. I hope you won't mind if I take a little issue with that, at least as far as current case law goes. From something like 1909 to 1998, the average copyright was extended about 80 years during a period of only 89 years, which basically wipes out that quote that you mentioned from the Constitution that says, for a limited amount of time. The World Intellectual Property Organization makes no bones about the fact that they would like to have permanent copyright, and certainly going from an average copyright of, say, 15 years in 1900 to an average copyright of 95 years now makes it so that if you take your kid to see The Lion King or something when they're 5 years old, that they would have to live to be 100 years old before they could legally make some kind of offshoot copy of that, use it to make their own work. You know, and Disney, of course, is famous for making movies out of Mark Twain stories and Cinderella and Sleeping Beauty and all this other stuff that was in the public domain. But obviously, Mark Twain would not have been in the public domain if they had a 95-year copyright at the time. So they're kind of want to have their bread buttered on both sides.
I won't argue with you about the fact that these very long terms, the Sonny Bono Copyright Term Extension Act, one of the last things that Sonny Bono did as a gift to his buddies in the entertainment industry, is something that is very hard to justify. When I was referring to the balance, I was referring to, in principle, that's what intellectual property is designed to do. The fact that in certain specific situations they don't do it, I totally agree with you that it was the copyright term extension was entirely unjustified. I want to make one point there that I think I urge people like you to keep in mind, and that is that we have a problem with intellectual property legislation in this country, which is that we have a bunch of groups that are very well coordinated and very well funded and who make it a point to make sure that their interests are heard. And then you have the vast, dispersed, and uncoordinated group, we the public. And so as a result, those people who study legislative processes, and they use a term that's called public choice theory, which explains how certain laws come about. And when you have different kinds of stakeholders, a dispersed set of stakeholders, and a well-coordinated set of stakeholders, the well-coordinated efforts always wins.
Right.
And in this case, what you end up with is legislation where the import of what you're saying is not made available to the people who are voting on these things.
Yeah.
And after all, congressmen know that their reelection chances do not depend on whether how they vote on an intellectual property legislation.
No,
as a result, you know, they're perfectly happy to kowtow to the lobbying interests.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, I wasn't sure you could still hear me. For example, you know, Robert James Waller is going to make $100 million off of 100 pages of Madison County. And generation after generation after generation of his offspring are going to basically be the landed gentry of the information age from one work that may have taken him a couple months to write. There's no other job you could possibly have in the world that could do that. Michael Jordan still has to come back and play more basketball if he wants to get, you know, $50 million a year to do that. And you also mentioned music, I think, you know, like Napster. I think that some of what's going on the Internet is a rebellion against these trends. As I recall, the Recording Industry Association of America, or RIAA, whatever it stands for, 60% of them were convicted for price fixing. And still never, the prices of CDs haven't come down. And as you probably know, you can make your own CD on your own computer for sometimes as little as a dime. So somewhere a $17 CD isn't getting anywhere near $17 to the artists who made it.
Let me just try and respond to a few of the points that you make. You are absolutely correct that some authors do profit a great deal. But keep in mind that people who are creators and inventors don't know that their work is going to be profitable or not. There's lots of books written and lots of inventions made and lots of patents that are granted that are entirely worthless, that have absolutely no market acceptance whatsoever. So the fact that some of them are winners and some of them are magnificent winners is just the way it turns out.
This is kind of a law that's been protecting only the very richest of the rich. You're absolutely right. 99% of all the books published this year will not be in print as long as the bridges of Madison County.
Right, but keep in mind that nobody is forcing anyone to buy Madison County or any other book. It's only when the books are bought that the person is actually making some money. Otherwise, they don't make any money.
Okay, let's say I bought a copy of Gone with the Wind in 1939. And the copyright law then was 28 years with a possible 28-year extension. Now, under that law, I have got a right to copy that book 56 years later and sell my own edition. Now, obviously, that's never going to happen because every time any of the works from the 30s or the 40s get close, or sorry, the 30s or the 20s, the golden age of movies and stuff like that, get close to begin the public domain, somebody like Sonny Bono comes along and jacks it up higher because of Mickey Mouse and Winnie the Pooh and stuff like that from 1926 and 1927. So those things, Disney paid something like $200 million for the rights to Winnie the Pooh 2 years ago or something because of their own legislation to extend the copyright. Now, if they can afford to spend $200 million for the copyright of one single set of characters there for Winnie the Pooh, then you can imagine what kind of money they can put into Congress to make sure that they never listen to us. I couldn't get a hold of any congressman's ear when the Sonny Bono law was coming up. And I don't know if you are aware of it or not, but that law was passed within 24 hours of when Clinton was impeached.
Actually, as a matter of fact, not only do I know about the law, but I actually signed on to a bunch of 150 intellectual property law professors who tried to do our best to explain that this law was quite nonsensical.
Yeah,
you two guys are not disagreeing. The guests on the call are not disagreeing.
No, right? But he can tell you that he didn't get any mileage out of those 150 people.
Yeah.
In part, it's important that all of us speak up. And that's the fact that we sometimes win and lose makes us a good democracy. In a pluralistic society, sometimes you win, sometimes you lose.
You never win on copyright. Not in this last century, not since Gutenberg. When Gutenberg came along, he got books for the masses, and that created the first of our current copyright laws. And when the steam and electric presses came along at the turn of the last century and created all those reprint houses, the 1909 copyright law killed them off. When the Xerox machine came along, the 1976 copyright killed off the use of that. And now the Internet has come along, the 1998 law, it kills off what you can put on there. There are millions of books that you can't put on the Internet just because of those laws that I just mentioned, and obviously there were more. Millions of books that could be on the Internet, free of charge, that are only covered by these copyright laws because you could copy them. It wasn't illegal when it was hard, when only the rich people could make copies before Gutenberg. There was no real copyright at all. And as every time you get a mass movement, I can't remember the term you used, but the new technology revolution, obviously Gutenberg was one, and the steam and electric presses were one, and the Xerox machine was one, and the Internet was one. Each time that happens, they pass a law against it. It's okay. We can have a public domain as long as the public can't really have the public domain. I've probably taken enough time.
Well, I have a couple of other people here I want to get to. I don't know if, Jay, you want to make any further.
I did want to just make a couple of very quick points. And first, that you should keep in mind, by the way, that whenever you have an intellectual property work, whether it's a copyright on a book or whether it's a patent for an invention, the term simply is a period of time when you could exercise that right. It doesn't mean, by the way, that after 18 months or 2 years, there's anybody who even wants to buy your book. And it doesn't mean that after a year or two, your patent, you may have a patent for 20 years from the date of filing. But keep in mind that people should want to use use your patented product. There are other products that are get better. And in this fast information technology age, obsolescence of products is very, very fast. It's just a few years. So too much emphasis on terms can be a little deceiving. A couple other things that I wanted to mention. The caller mentioned Michael Jordan. I assure you, Michael Jordan has the finest intellectual property attorneys in the country, and the contracts that he signs, I've seen some of the sports contracts when I was in private practice. They are wonderfully protective of all his intellectual property rights. He does not need to come back to play basketball to make money. And finally, as far as Napster goes, I do agree with the caller that one of the real issues in the Napster case is the role of the middleman. And this is often ignored. It is not the artists. The artists can get paid through the internet. They can set up their own websites and they can have people pay for it and sell it directly. Ultimately, it's the middlemen like RIAA who are being threatened by the internet. This is not about people who want to enjoy music. They're willing to pay for it. And let's keep in mind that the prices of this comes down when transaction costs are reduced and the ability to replicate is reduced. You might be able to actually pay pennies for songs. And so I agree with the caller that ultimately it is about creators being rewarded. And it's the middlemen who are being squeezed out who are now trying to use every tactic they can. By the way, this is not just an intellectual property problem. The RIAA happens to be the middleman with respect to video and music content, but this is true for small vineyards in California that want to sell through the internet. Big vineyards have gone and lobbied Congress, and they've used the fact that you don't want to sell alcohol to minors as a ploy to try to prevent these small vineyards from selling through the internet. The car dealerships are doing the same thing. I mean, car dealerships are being squeezed out, and they're acting to prevent car companies from directly selling through the internet. So I mean, the fact is that middlemen are being squeezed all around, and they don't like it.
We are at our midpoint already. Our guest is Jay Kaysen. He's professor of law at University of Illinois. He teaches on rights in the areas of intellectual property and also the regulation of cyberspace. We're talking a bit this morning about intellectual property and the internet, and your questions are welcome. We have some other folks here ready to go. Next caller is Belgium, line number 4.
Yes. I don't truly understand the thing about this intellectual property and stuff. You paint the Mona Lisa, okay? And somebody comes and looks at that. Now, each time that person looks at it, he doesn't have to pay for it. But, you know, why should a song have more protection? In the same way, you know, I don't understand this thing. You know, he can make it, but that's not considered valuable. But the person who makes a song, it's considered valuable. Can you explain this to me?
There is nothing to prevent you from hearing a song the same way as there is nothing to prevent you from seeing the Mona Lisa. Are you allowed to make multiple copies of the song and multiple copies of the Mona Lisa and try to sell it and distribute it and so on? So it's the reproduction right, and it's the public performance and the public display right and the right to make future works based on this work. Those are where intellectual property comes in. I mean, you're absolutely allowed to listen to whatever you want, and you're absolutely allowed to see whatever you want. There's nobody stopping you from doing that.
No, sir, that's not exactly the point I'm making. The artist that made the Mona Lisa was paid to make the Mona Lisa, and he gave it away, okay, and to the person who bought it, and it became a famous work of art. But Da Vinci accepted the money he had and went down the road and was happy. Gentleman writes a song. He goes to somebody and sells that song to somebody and says, okay, this is a good song, fine, and he gets paid for it. Why, after that initial compensation, why does it have to continue on forever and ever and ever?
I think the confusion that you're having is a legitimate one, and it's a very common one. And that is the difference between the intellectual property right and what your copy, what you have the right to do with your copy. In other words, if I buy a book, I have a copy of the book, and I have paid for it. And so I have the right to use the book any which way I want for my own joy and pleasure. And similarly, if I pay for a copy of the Mona Lisa, I'm allowed to do whatever I want with my copy. What I'm not allowed to do, and that's equal in both cases, what I'm not allowed to do now is to start using the Xerox machine and scanning the book in, and just like I'm not allowed to scan the Mona Lisa in. In other words, you have paid for the right to use that copy. It's called the first sale doctrine. And you can do whatever you want with your copy of that song or that book, so on and so forth. Where things come in is when you take that and you start then impinging on the broader right to reproduce and to distribute copies of that work, which of course still belongs. The intellectual property right to that work still belongs with the creator. He is not given that right to you. He is simply given you a copy of his creation.
Even though he never makes another copy of it.
Correct. That's his prerogative. He doesn't need to. He, I can write one book, I can make one copy, and I can give it to you for a dollar. I still own the copyright.
Thank you very much.
Right. I think, maybe, again, the difference is that it's a different world now than it was when Da Vinci painted the Mona Lisa, and that perhaps then craftspeople did have the idea that when you create something, you sell it, and then it's gone. You have no more right. But nowadays, that we have a very different sort of idea that says that you still the creative work may indeed sign some rights away, and may indeed assign to someone else the right to duplicate and sell it. However, there's still this idea that the creator still retains some right to that thing, and of course, in the case of if I write a book and Simon & Schuster publishes the book, and then somebody violates the copyright, it's Simon & Schuster are the guys that are going to come after you, not me. But it's still the case that I do still retain some right, even though I have entered into this contractual relationship with Simon & Schuster. They're going to pay me some money. They're going to distribute the work.
Absolutely. And of course, there is still commonality in the sense that the creator of the Mona Lisa, he does get paid when the work is commissioned. Royal families did pay these artists. And more importantly, they made sure that the right of attribution was maintained. In other words, it's very important that they indicated that this was the artist who did it. The royal family didn't come along and take his name off and put their name on. And they didn't try and deface the work and things like that. And the integrity of the work was maintained. So it's not just about making money. It's about rights of attribution. It's about integrity and other things, which we've known for a long time.
Yeah. And that's also, there are other cases where people have made the argument that, for example, if you make a painting and I buy it from you, and I decide that I think the color should be different and paint over it, then you could come back to me and say, no, you can't do that. The fact that you own it and that I paid for it gives me the right to have it and display it, but not to change it. Right?
Absolutely. Within limits, you're of course allowed to doodle on a book that you buy and so on. But yeah. but you are correct that there are certain rights of attribution and rights of integrity in the work as a whole which survive any kind of transfer.
Okay. Well, let's talk with some other folks here. I guess next will be Champagne, line two. Hello?
Line two?
Yes.
Hi. This has been a really interesting conversation. I appreciate the guest talking about some things. I was a little concerned at first, but your perspective really reassured me. Some of the callers have been basically treating ideas as if they're less valuable than any other product or service that human beings create, and I think that might be one of the big problems. Ideas are valuable. Ideas are the products that some people produce. Some people produce, they give you a hamburger when you give them $1.15. Some people produce a tangible product. Other people produce ideas, and that's the difference. Failure to support the right for people to protect their ideas is simply theft. In my book, personal opinion here, Napster is theft because it's encouraging people to steal music without paying somebody for it. Now, you get into the argument of the middlemen and all that business. Well, that's a whole another question. But the fact is that somebody should be getting compensated, whoever owns the rights to that idea. Getting back to the idea of, getting away from the music and entertainment industry, I think that's an easy target to pick on. My business is doing research and creating training programs for organizations. I don't come up with a lot of brand new ideas myself, but what I do is I take the ideas from tens, 20s, hundreds of other researchers, combine it together in a new way, and that is a unique product. I always, always, always give credit to the people who I do research from. That's ethical, it's just, and it gives people the right credit. If I'm going to take more than a couple of sentences or a paragraph, I want to make sure I get permission to be able to do that because somebody spent their time, energy, and effort doing that research. If I didn't, it would be literally theft from that person and preventing them from doing their livelihood. And I think that's a big misconception that people are saying, oh, well, these rules are ridiculous. Wrong. They are protecting people's livelihood. Otherwise, it's just simply theft. It's using somebody else's ideas to market them, sell them, and profit for them as if they were your own. You use them for your own personal situations within a private relationship. I'm sharing this quote with a friend. No, I don't have to worry about giving somebody a notation, citation, or even a dollar of royalty. But on the other hand, if I'm going to go ahead and make a profit on that presentation, and I'm going to go ahead and use somebody else's material to make money for myself, it is just right and ethical that I go ahead and compensate that person. So there's a perspective I haven't heard from callers yet so far. I wanted to toss that out there and just see what your reaction is. So I'll let you respond.
I actually you will not get any complaints from me on virtually anything you said. I do agree with you that ideas run the world. Ideas are important. And free writing, that's what economists call it, is a serious problem. That's why we have intellectual property laws. We have intellectual property laws so that when you put an idea out there, people cannot massively appropriate it without paying you. Because what ends up happening then is that those ideas become undervalued. And they're what economists call our public goods. And when you have public goods, then the production of these becomes diminished because those things are not valued by society. And if inventions and innovations are not valued by society, then people are going to try to, as a rational matter, they're going to try to engage in doing other things that are more valuable. And they're not going to innovate and they're not going to invent. So I do agree with you. As a matter of fact, the analogy to theft doesn't really carry it as far as it should. When you think of theft, you just think of one-time stealing. That's the problem with intellectual property. There's multiple stealing, multiple times, and the thing still remains. So you can continue to go on and on and on. So theft is actually doesn't do justice to the amount of stealing that you can do with intellectual property. As far as Napster goes, I agree with you. I think Napster definitely was engaging in illegal conduct. But I think it's a little bit disingenuous to say that it's the creators of the work who are being deprived of their ability to profit from it. It's not. It's RIAA that wants to be in the business of distributing music and distributing content. That's the people who really want to do it. Yeah. Because you can use Napster and you can still have creators getting rewarded. After all, if you go to a site called afternapster.com, you'll see that there is 25 different services that offer peer-to-peer file sharing. And with the various consumers rating each and every one of them, there was about 25 of them the last time I checked, and there are several others, Audio Galaxy and so on, that seem to work pretty well. So there are perfectly legal ways of doing the things that Napster intended to do. And I think the important thing to realize is that the creators of the music, the work, the content ought to be rewarded. But at the same time, we ought to be careful that the wonderful advantages of the medium, which allow a lot of transaction costs to go away and a lot of these middlemen to get squeezed out, they shouldn't take the refuge of the law and basically prevent the internet from becoming a more efficient medium, which is really what it's all about.
Mm-hmm. And of course, Udo, one of the things we haven't really touched on, and we may not have time to, but it's always going to be the case that people that are going to be pushing the envelope, they're going to be trying to getting around, as you said, as we were just kind of getting ready to talk, one of the big stories in this field these days is things that people do to try to get around the systems that creators and distributors use to try to prevent copying. It's like the, you know, I can go out and buy a DVD and sit at home and watch that, but the DVD people who sold me that don't want me making copies, passing them out to my friends, or making copies and selling them, which is, of course, a huge, worldwide is a huge, huge problem. But so they put something on there to try to prevent me from doing that. And of course, there's always going to be somebody coming along trying to figure out some way, and people already have figured out a way to get around that. And it seems like these forces are constantly going to be sort of pursuing one another.
You're absolutely right. In the case of DVDs, they have something called a content scrambling system, CSS. And there was a Norwegian group that called itself Masters of Reverse Engineering that came up with a DECSS, D-E-C-S-S, that tried to defeat technology protection device, essentially a mode of encryption that was put on there in order to prevent the copying of DVDs. But the important thing there to keep in mind is, and this is something that Congress did not realize when it passed the 1998 DMCA, Digital Millennium Copyright Act, and Title I of that act makes it illegal to circumvent any kind of technological protection measure. The problem that Congress did not anticipate was that there are some legitimate and legal uses of the content that are now precluded because technology is so wonderful at keeping everybody out. It's there is imagine if I were to teach my students how juries deliberate cases, and I wanted to get a clip from 12 Angry Men, I couldn't do it. That's fair use. Congress has other laws that says, hey, you're perfectly allowed to do that for teaching face-to-face in a classroom. But now I can't get access to it because this technological protection device that they've put in there prevents me from getting access to things that I should be able to get access to. And that's the real problem. The real problem is that these kinds of laws that are passed by Congress, which basically says all these technological protection measures are okay, essentially do away with things like fair use and do away with the balance that is at the heart of intellectual property law. The balance is so critical. I can give you a number of other examples where basically there was a famous case where a gentleman was testifying. He was a researcher at Xerox Palo Alto Research Center, and he was testifying in the Washington Redskins case. And he wanted to go through a whole bunch of old movies to show that the term red skin is a disparaging term. And he couldn't go through a whole bunch of movies and get access to, just to prove his point. And he couldn't do it because of Title I of the DMCA, which is this anti-circumvention law. And so that's where things – it's sort of like somebody saying, hey, you have national parks and you're allowed to enjoy it. And then suddenly somebody comes around and puts a fence around the national parks and keeps me out and doesn't give me the barbed wires to cut through it.
Uh-huh. Hear that? What they'll do. Every time you go in, they'll charge you.
Well, that's true.
That's right. We have a number of other callers. Jake Kaysen is our guest. He's a professor of law at the University of Illinois. Also has positions in the Department of Electrical and Computer Engineering and the Institute of Government and Public Affairs. And his particular areas of interest are indeed intellectual property law and the regulation of cyberspace, as well as science, technology, and the law. And we're talking about intellectual property and the Internet. We have a number of callers, and we'll try to get in at least a couple more in the time that remain. The next person in line would be Line 1 in Urbana. Hello.
Yeah, I have two questions. One relating to MIT's decision to put their put their own curriculum online. I don't know how far they've gotten with that, but I know that one of the issues that brought up was that the professors themselves felt that some of their rights were being eroded in their intellectual property. I was wondering if you had any info on that. And then the other question would be some of these internet forums where people subscribe to a forum and put in their comments. Who owns that? Does anyone really have a right to the contributions either the people who contribute to them or the host of the forum. So MIT and forums.
As far as putting the syllabus online goes, I think actually that was something that was beginning to happen, and it really was something that MIT took advantage of to give themselves a lot of good publicity by putting all the syllabus online. The important thing to keep in mind here is that it's a little bit deceiving to say that you're putting all the syllabus online. The ultimate question is whether we can download everything that is there in the syllabus, and we then have the right to distribute it and give it to our students. In other words, so what if you're able to provide me with a list of copyrighted works that's part of my syllabus? It tells me that that's important, but it ultimately, it only goes that far. I have to be able to get to that copyrighted work, and I have to be able to use it in my classroom and make 50 copies and or be able to put it on my website. And do I have then the right to put it on my website? In other words, is MIT going to go and get the clearances so that it allows me to use the content which is linked to in the syllabus and so on? So I think it's a wonderful first step, and I think it's great, and MIT has received a great deal of publicity for it. But keep in mind that it really doesn't go quite as far as you might think it does. And so it remains to be seen if they're going to go and get clearances for all of us to go and use the content, not just simply the link to the content. And the second point with respect to the authorship, you are absolutely correct. That is a gray area. Traditionally, academics have been a loophole, if you will, a clear exception that the courts have carved out. And they basically said, well, typically when you work for a company, all your work is a work for hire and it's owned by the company. But in the case of academics, they have understood that in order to promote academic freedom and in order to allow academia to be an attractive job in a way, all the works that are created by professors typically are owned by the professors and not by the universities. This is typically related to course material, books they write, articles they write, and so on. One clear exception to that has always been inventions, which has traditionally been owned by the university. Now the question is, where does online content come in? Where does it fall? Is it going to be treated in a patent-centric paradigm where the university owns everything, or a copyright-centric paradigm where professors own everything? And that is very much a topic that is heavily debated. And bottom line is that universities see distribution of courseware and online content as being a way to generate a lot of revenue. And that wasn't the case before. And they see that there has now been essentially a paradigm change. And so they're less willing to give professors the complete rights to online content with respect to their courses. As far as chat forums and so on, typically you are correct that the copyrighted work in the chat forum is owned by the people who are typically setting up the chat forum, whether it's AOL or somebody else. Keep in mind, by the way, that anything and everything you say is not capable of copyright protection. In other words, there has to be a certain amount of minimum expression before something can be copyrighted. Nobody has a copyright to "It Was a Dark and Rainy Night," or William Gibson doesn't have the copyright to the word "cyberspace," which he used for the first time in his 1984 book, Neuromancer. So it doesn't mean that we all have to pay William Gibson 1 cent when we use the word cyberspace. So the little contributions that are made by people in a chat forum would not be individually copyrighted. Highly unlikely.
So you're saying that if there were particularly interesting exchanges in one of these forums between two or three contributors, and if I wanted to copy that out, I really need the permission of the people that set up the forum in the first place?
Well, that depends. I would say that if you wanted to reproduce a small part of it, you definitely want to check with the people in the forum, but it depends. If you're just going to take two or three lines, you probably, without knowing enough...
I was thinking more like three or four paragraphs, something like that.
Yeah. Well, you basically what you're saying is where does fair use stop and where does copyright infringement begin? And that's a very... it's a question that depends on an accurate investigation of the facts. I would say say that if you're going to take 3 or 4 paragraphs, you might want to just shoot off a letter to the chat forum, and you'll be pleasantly surprised that they'd be more than happy to let you take 3 or 4 paragraphs. It usually is not a problem.
Okay, thanks.
All right. We'll try and get real quick here. One more in Chicago, line 4. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I thought I might mention the following, which gives you another angle on the whole business of intellectual property rights. I've got one of my brothers went to work for Sylvania a long time ago in their television tube operation, and he went to work for them in upstate New York where they manufactured these television tubes. And after several years, he got transferred out to their plant in Pennsylvania, where they manufactured flash bulbs. And they had a problem down there where they were having something like 7 to 8% breakage, lots of waste in the manufacture of the flash bulbs, and it was costing them tons of money. They were manufacturing something over 100,000 of these flash bulbs a day, so you can see how it runs up. Anyhow, he designed machinery to produce these flash bulbs, which cut the wastage down to less than 1%, and of course made them lots of money. Not only that, but the design of this machinery permitted them to go into the manufacture of flash cubes, which would not have been feasible before that, and it made them lots more money. He was rewarded with a letter of thanks. And that was it. Of course, he had signed away his patent rights and all that when he went to work for them.
We're kind of getting to the point where we kind of got to wrap up. I guess my question would be, is that sort of still the way it is in industry, or has that started to change?
It has changed, and certainly you can try and choose to work for an employer who has a multi-tiered structure where he basically says you have an invention, and if it makes X amount of dollars, you get the proverbial $100 check, and if it makes more than X, you get 0.5%, and so on. But keep in mind that a lot of this, I'm not trying to come to the rescue of GTE Sylvania. They can do that themselves. But of course, GTE doesn't even exist anymore. It's Verizon. What I wanted to say was, keep in mind that there's massive R&D costs and there is massive infrastructure that was relied on by your brother. So those are the things that you don't see. In other words, he could not have done that work without a lot of stuff that was available in GTE. And that's I completely sympathize as a scientist at IBM. I obtained several patents, and I did get the equivalent of the word of thanks, and this is so on. So I do understand what you're saying.
Well, thanks for being with us. I'm sure that we can, on another day, we can find some more issues to talk about. But for now, we'll have to say thanks. Jake Kaysen, professor of law, U of I. We appreciate it.
Thank you, David.